Now, in people's history, Billy Kay travels to the South Ayrshire to hear one of the greatest disasters in Scottish mining history. Knock Shinnoch.
Well, it had rained for several days, and heavy, heavy rain it was. And the men were coming up with that, and they were soaking wet. They were coming up soaking every day.
I feel my mother must have known something about it, because that night that it happened, she ran up to a fella across the road and she asked him if there was any chance anywhere in the pit flooding. And he said the only bit that he thought about was number 7. And she could hardly get back up the steps to the house. I would go and help her because she knew that's what he had been talking about.
It was common talk with the miners in that area, in number 5 area, that there was something going to happen. There were different things taking place there, different strata coming down. There were talking even bones coming down with different falls. And it latterly was eggshells, that kind of thing. But it was common talk with all miners that there something was going to take place.
He also told me that he was nearly up through to the daisies. He must have knew that he was going too near the surface.
When did he say that to you?
That was the night before the disaster.
The whole thing was they just followed the seam. And the seam was actually rising to the surface and they just kept going on to the surface. And as it proved to be, they just went that bit too far.
The people of New Cumnock in Ayrshire, recalling the days in early September 1950 that changed their lives forever. The village was dominated by the thriving Knockshinnoch Castle Colliery, employing over 700 men and producing 5,000 tonnes of coal per week. The old miner's saying, "Ye hae to drive your road to catch your coal," was to prove apocryphal to the men on the back shift in number 5 heading early on Thursday evening, September 7, when the seam was driven too near the surface and a huge inrush of sodden moss and mud crashed in on them.
Well, we were working away doing this duke at the coal, and this wee fella come doing it, run the duke, brought the hutch stairs, and he told us what they make for the West Mine turn, that Knockshinnoch Dam had burst.
You could hear the roars of the peat and moss and water and whatever rushing down that number 5 heading.
When we were walking out, there had been a load of hutches in the road out to the bottom, and the man had run into this slush, muck and mud, and the hutches were coming slowly in the mine.
Where the inrush had took place, coming down through all the buttons, it was shoving the local with about 40 full hatches of coal back in the road. And local driver jumped out the local and ran back into where we were.
And this thing was coming in towards you, and there was a lot of water getting pushed in front of it. And then the rest, it was just like, as I say, just like a dung midden moving in towards you.
The overman had went in to investigate what had took place, and he came across 2 workmen that were in that area, and he took them through all the stoops, through to safety. And I can tell you they were like hunted deer, their faces.
Well, the roads coming into there was blocked. That's when the fear and everything else happened to you.
Alex McCracken, one of 116 men who found themselves entombed and gathered together at the West Mine Turn. It was quickly established that there was no road out. 2 other men survived the initial inrush, Alec Clapperton.
When the overman went through that area, he met these 2 men making their way to the pit bottom to get up the pit. And one of these men had said to the other, "I've left my jacket at the loading point and my watch is in it. Have a minute and I'll go back and get it." And he went away back, and during that time there were a new inrush had took place in a different area. Come in and trap them, cut these men off.
They now joined a total of 13 missing men. On the surface, shock gave way to action as all thoughts turned to rescue. On his way to the pit to volunteer that night, Colin McClatchy found himself in a farmyard contributing to a hopeless effort to stem the inrush by filling the crater with any materials that came to hand.
I was up the top of these stacks with a hay fort, and I was there the whole night. Part of the night we emptied the stackyard, and thereafter we were given saws and axes and sent up to cut down a wee wood copse. So we cut down every tree was in that, loaded them into the lorries, and when there were no more trees left, it was daylight, and I got my first look at the crater. And oh my goodness, after we'd emptied that stackyard, and we'd put all the trees in it, and it was such a puny effort. It was a terrible thing to see. And then we realised the enormity of this thing.
I went up there to see the crater, and to me it looked like looking at a helicopter into Hampden Park. That's how big the area was.
The whole in appearance was tapered like a funnel, and everything swirling in towards that hole. Just as you can imagine, if you drew the plug in the bath and the water swirled away as you came to the end of the water. So this was like a soupy substance entering that hole.
Douglas Blackwood, an apprentice electrician at the time, it was Douglas who answered the telephone call, which had such a bearing on the fate of trapped men like Andrew McDicken.
Well, I still maintain to this day that if the phone had stopped working, we wouldn't have survived.
When you're thinking and all the cables that come in these mines and the phone cable just swinging them, and this tremendous surge of peat that come down and actually pushed a locomotive in a full rake of tubs back in the haulage. And yet, for some reason, that one cable survived.
Matt Sanderson. News of the disaster spread like wildfire, and miners from all over Ayrshire and beyond flocked to join the rescue teams, some dressed in their best suits for a night out, dramatically interrupted. Jessie Lopez was one of hundreds of women at the pit head, waiting for news of her husband and father.
Oh, there was an awful lot of folk at the pit head. I mean, I think there'd be some new every family knew coming up there.
There were people here from everywhere. There was television cameras, the airplanes got round about the place, and the atmosphere was dreadful. But they never gave up, of course.
Well, it was just something that'll happen instantaneously with men. They'll go and help their fellow man.
I met a couple of guys down there. One had his flannels on and his Saturday night shoes down the pit. On a sports jacket. I don't know how he got there. He must just have got a lamp. It was a very emotional thing. You had the whole range of emotions. You had elation for people that was going up. You had dread for the people that you didn't know whether they were up or no. We didn't know who was shut in and all that sort of thing. So the whole gamut of the human emotion was there.
At that time, of course, no one knew the extent of the tragedy underground, where 11 men were killed instantly, engulfed by the moss. The brigades were still fighting for the lives of all 129 men. Ironically, the first confirmed victims of Knockshinnagh were among the helpers on the surface.
When you come up the mine, they're aware, blanket around your shoulders, cigarette, light a match for you, and a pat on the back, and just to make you feel good. And unfortunately, once getting near the end of the thing, a young Salvation Army couple had been there. I don't know how long they'd been there, but I think they'd been there too long, because they ran off the road and were killed on the way home. That was another tragedy within a tragedy.
Underground, despair followed elation as hope came and went. Old maps revealed that a mere 24 feet coal barrier separated the men from a narrow tunnel in the old Bank 6 workings. They formed teams of men to hauk out the coal, but realised immediately they got through that the other side was full of lethal fire damp, gas which could come through and kill the trapped men before a rescue could even be attempted. On the Friday night, therefore, instead of the hoped-for walkout, they were sealed back in. Fear and hunger were taking their toll, but the reactions varied from individual to individual.
I remember one man, the talk about panic, well, as I say, there was an origin a wee bit more excitable than others. And this one man insisted he could go through with a wet cloth through his face. So the Phoenix up somebody says, well, if you think that, on you go. But he didn't go. And another voice said, get something down, you're only closing steward. Kenny was on his feet. And that's when he lifted his jacket and he flapped it. Like a housewife at the fireside rug out, Ken, but he just says, I'll give you so-and-so, Stuart. And then he sat down as if nothing had ever happened.
Some of the miners were gathering crisps and leftovers that had threw away maybe the day before and supposed to be eating them.
and they were drinking water out of a drum which was used for pneumatic boring. And they were drinking that water now.
And the Thursday night before the game had tears, the place had caved in. I was sitting eating an orange at Peace Dump. And Speed Riddle came to me on the Friday. Joe, he said, why do you wear your own skin? So I left it sitting at the foot of the heating. I mean, we went that water heat where I was working in. Went to the foot of the heating, the folks there on skin bar. And it was great getting a bit in your mouth on the Friday afternoon. That the first bite would go again for the Thursday.
John Fulton. Starving, a dirty piece of orange peel lifted you. In fear and despair, the characters among your comrades gave you back hope for a future.
There was a sing-song started, and I always remember where I say was the first singer, and it was Wallace Anderson. And that was the song I sang. We was trapped in a coal pit, and he sung, if I was a blackbird, I'd whistle and sing, and follow the ship that my true love sails in. In a rich, clear voice, it was lovely, Ken. A wee bit emotional afterwards, not at the time, but when it's repeated maybe today, Ken, it brings back memories.
Davy Jess, he was a life and soul of the party, Davy Jess. And in time, he got wee buffer. He was a small miner. Davy had wee buffer on his knee, and he was doing a ventriloquist act with wee buffer on his knee to keep the morale of the men up. And there really was quite a good concert going. There were boys singing hymns, and they were singing songs that maybe you never wished to hear, but they were singing them. I can mind John Robertson singing The Old Rugged Cross, and Davy singing The Bonnie Lass of Ballochmyle, and then Honey, Willie McKnight. He was really rich despondent, sat lay most of the time, and I heard him singing Goodbye Old Ship of Mine, Willie McKnight.
During that time, I was asked to sing, and being a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, I sung The Old Rugged Cross. It was a hymn that was well known, and so they all joined in the chorus. And at the same time, there must have been somebody on the phone at the time, and it was heard on the surface. I sung that hymn with the view that the rest of the men hearing it would probably realise that Christ did die on the cross, not for just for me, but for them also.
Although the men couldn't walk out, the rescue brigades, trained to use complex breathing apparatus, were eventually able to come through the gas and into the men. Along with them came food, drink, and the NCB Deputy Labour Director, Davy Park, a local man respected by the men.
I remember the very first time a brigade team came through, they just stood and they looked round about. Then after 2 minutes, they just walked away. There wasn't a word spoken.
When Davy Park came through, the morale of the men just went down.
Davy Park was a local man, and he was reared as a miner the same as we were in the pits here, and he knew the area where we were and where the gas was. And he volunteered. He came through and volunteered to come through the seal with the Proctus apparatus on, which means you have to be trained in that apparatus. He come through with the expectations to stay along with us. Every man apparently was rescued if that was going to come off, and they sealed him in along with us. But Dave didn't get an easy time when he come through.
Just after he come through to begin with, he started telling us about how it was the world news almost, and the media was headlines and the concentration of efforts to get us out. And he was stopped abruptly by one of the men that was talkative. We're not wanting to hear all that. What we want to ken is when are we getting out? And he said, we are still hopeful of making a rescue. I thought that was a terrible answer, and that was the only time I felt a bang of fear, of pain in the bottom of my stomach.
For Bill Lopez, that fear was compounded with fear for the fate of his father-in-law, with whom he and his wife lived. He had been working in number 5 heading.
This was always in the back of my mind. When I go home, if I get out,
how am I going to explain this? Because there was something to explain the Basque, and where he was, I'm out, where's he?
But she can't within herself. I think there was no hope. She never was in her bed. She sat in a chair all the time. Her ankles were all swollen out of her shoes, just sitting waiting and somebody coming. And she can't, he wasn't coming back. She sat like that all weekend. Never was in her bed.
By Saturday morning, efforts to clear gas from the roadways of the bank pit by using fans had failed. In Knockshinnagh too, fire damp levels were rising dangerously.
Well, I never slept because not so far you were frightened to sleep. Mm-hmm. Because the gas was getting that, it was progressing that quick round about the area, Ken, and it was coming out for areas in the inside areas, never mind for the bank side. Your mind wouldn't let you sleep.
Latter end, the gas was that bad. We had to lie down. We had to keep down because just above you, I mean, you could put your Lenny up and it was just blowing out. The gas was just above your head.
On the reading on the safety lamp was 2.5%, which means the minute you rose and filled your lungs with that, you were away. As quick as that. When your gas gets to 5%, it's the explosive range when it gets to 5%. And, I mean, it would only need a spark on the other side there, and it would have been a disaster. It would have been more than us. It would been all the men that was trying to help us to get out. These men should have got a medal, in my opinion, for the work they did for to get us out. Because I think it was one of the biggest rescues in mining history. With the conditions that prevailed and with the amount of risk that was taken, if they'd been sticking to regulations, they'd just have sailed off and left us there.
It was decided to attempt a rescue using Salvis equipment, successfully used by trained firefighters but untested in the pits, its intricacies unknown to miners. Chains of rescue men were stationed along the dark, gas-filled roadway to act as escorts, while others taught the men to breathe with the Salvis. With half an hour of air in the canister and a struggle through rough roads before them, they were elated to hear that one of the older miners, Juan Caracido, had got through in 14 minutes. Time, however, was running out.
I had a young brother and he was panicking enough getting the apparatus on without anything else happening. When he was going through toward the fresh air base, the strap holding the mouthpiece had broke coming through the hole, and one of the brigade men had the presence of mind to just put his head into an airline, which is an airbag, and fix it back on him. So he was a stretcher case going out.
Somewhere between the escape hole and the first ventilated part, I remember my head started swimming, and I realised I was going to get in faint or lose consciousness, and we couldn't have been far from the main base, because it maybe must have been out of oxygen, but it hit it off my face completely, and he put his hand above my oxter and he just said move, and within a short time I saw the two lights ahead of me, and that was the first ventilated spot where my local doctor and my local first aid captain was with the doctor. For I remember the doctor just says, how do you feel? And I said my head was pounding. And no waste of effort or words, just down there, and he points to the floor. And I lay down, and my first aid leader, he says to him, give him three. And John put the mask over my face, and it in three big intakes, and my head cleared immediately. No hangover. Immediately the head was cleared. And Dr. Five just says, on your way.
When they took the last group out, I would say that things was deteriorating to such an extent that they had to try and quicken things up a bit. I think that if it had been maybe, say, another, even I'd go as far as to say half an hour to an hour, and I don't think if only we'd been left still in, I don't think they would have got to it.
I was suspicious that I wouldn't be able to go with this apparatus. But once we'd won, it was all right. But by the time we got out, our breath was red hot, wasn't it? My breath was absolutely red hot when I got out. But it was having to get out.
What was it like seeing your man coming up?
Oh, terrible. Their eyes were staring their head. They were just glaring at you. And they were just taken into ambulances and taken away to Ballochmyle, to the hospital.
So did you feel that you couldn't respond to your man being back because your father wasn't coming back?
Oh, no, I was awful glad to see him in the door, but I kent my daddy wasn't coming back then either. Just kent he wasn't coming. And then to croon it, that was 21st of January before they even got his body. She got it through a paper coming in the door. The reporters got the news before the minister or anybody else could come and tell her. That was worse then, I think, than it was even at the time of the disaster. She never was out the door, hardly, to his body, debtors to get his body. She never was out. She didn't like to go. She was feared to meet anybody in case they spoke to her about it, and she broke down in the street or something. She wouldn't go outside.
The agony of the families of the 13 lost men was to last for months. The day after the major rescue was completed, it had been decided that rescue attempts in Number 5 heading posed grave dangers to rescuers. The men were presumed dead. After a few weeks, work at Knockshinnagh resumed.
They employed the men. It was in the disaster, and 6 hour shifts for to take the sledge out. And it was a very nervous thing for men to be doing. I know I wouldn't have walked in the mine myself for one end to the other. For weeks and months after it, well, that's the kind of state the disaster had left in, and most men.
We had most rights when after we started cleaning out the pit and what we had before it. And all this muck had to be cleaned out, and sometimes you had to run, and the water's fleeing right out the mine, about 4 feet high, and to the bottom.
I was in the shift that went and got the two men. It was entombed, and it wasn't in the sludge. That was a very traumatic experience. It was lying around about the barrel where they knew there was water, and to the expired.
I think it was very sad that they lying like two men in a double bed. Their boots was off and lying tight together. And they had been walking about, we'll say, for maybe 9 or 10 days alive, trapped. And then realised and just maybe exhausted or cold just to lay down. But they lay down together.
Everybody, I would be safe in saying that everybody turned up for the funeral. Even the men that was working, trying to recover the bodies, they were allowed to stop work and walk over to the cemetery with their working clothes on to pay their last respects. But yin funeral in particular that sticks with me was yin of the men that was trapped for about 10 days. He was a Salvation Army man. Johnny DL was his name. And that day that his funeral, the Salvation Army band led it. And I'll never forget, when they got to the cemetery gates, the band started to play a hymn, sweeping through the gates of the New Jerusalem, washed in the blood of the Lamb. And to me, I thought that was terrific. It's something I'll never forget.
John Robertson. The dead of Knockshinnagh joined those of Donny Bristle, Galston and Stan Rigg, miners who died in similar inrushes in the Scottish coalfield this century. Torrential rain, the failure to notice a sign warning of peat in the geological map where Number 5 was rising, human error, or simply driving your road to catch your coal. The debate over responsibility continues. The sadness will remain forever.
No, I think an act of God is something you kind of foresee.
Well, I think the predominant feeling in the aftermath that this is an accident and it should never have happened. If the regulations had been followed diligently, there would have been no disaster in Newcomen. The mining being in the industry that it was, there was always an underlying sort of resentment. I think the fact that you were wanting doing the pitch made you resentful to begin with. But certainly there was a lot of resentment against the NCB.
I remember one and it was in the Masonic Temple at the meeting, and he was shouting for the back of the hall, Hingham. I mean, he was a loner. But through and through, no. I think we felt sorry or sad for our manager, for Willie Halliday, and for Big John Bone, although he was a big stern man. You seen there was hunting, Ken, there was doom. You really felt sorry, no, angry.
It's an experience that we never forget. Any time the old Rugged Cross is sung anywhere, it brings a kind of lump to my throat, Ken, remembering just what happened on that eventful date away back in 1950, and the men that we can't wheel and not that had lost their lives.
That was an Odyssey production for Radio Scotland. The producer would like to thank the Band of the Salvation Army in Aberdeen for its help in making the programme.